This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, I'm honored by all of you being here, despite the wonderful resume. It's an extremely hard one, and I'm still, you know, sort of awed and amazed that the work has its outreach. In my sense of solitary pleasures, that I'm still alone and unknown, and crouching in indecision at home where I've lived for 40 years in the same old farmhouse with all my dead pets buried on the path to the door. So this is all very astonishing and wonderful, and I want to remind other artists that when someone mentions that I had, let's say, a Guggenheim Fellowship, they never say that it took 11 tries. And, you know, that's this masochistic humiliation where you have to ask the same friends over and over again, could you find a way to say that I deserve this? So the process is, the sense of striving is endless. And as the work accumulates, and what I'll show you tonight, I'll also remind you that almost all of it, with only one or two exceptions, is still in the shed. So that helps keep me very humble, because it's a, you know, kind of paradoxical situation. If there's this significant mythology, why is all the actual made, constructed work still in the barn? And I know that most artists always end up with most of their work in somebody's barn. So because Solitary Pleasures is such a provocative title, I wanted to think about it very, well, not terribly carefully, but a little bit carefully. And so I made some notes about what are the solitary pleasures, and I realized that that masturbation really isn't at this moment a solitary pleasure. It's really remedial, that being without a partner is its own kind of evisceration. It's an emptying of potentiality. And so that's part of why I have so many solitary pleasures for the last 7 or 8 years, because I'm on my own. So one of the main solitary pleasures is commuting on the bus from upstate New York near New Paltz, where I live, getting on that Adirondack Trailways bus, usually once a week, hoping that nobody is throwing up, screaming on the cell phone, or trying to kick my books over. And then if that's not happening, I can make notes for coming here today. That's a good solitary pleasure. And I guess I wrote down a breakfast of blackberries after I pulled them out of all the thorns. That's very satisfying. Anything about my contemporary cat, Minos, is a solitary pleasure, except it's companionable. But I actually have a secret solitary pleasure, and I've never found anyone of my realm who shares this. I have an ex-boyfriend, local, who researches everything dark about the government, the internment camps, all the details about 9/11, the thermite, the bankers who are really running everything. So every night I check in with the horrors that he's mailed me, and it's an important realm of research. And then in order to clear the decks, I put on another 15 minutes of Everybody Loves Raymond. I don't just put it on, I'm addicted. I don't have a TV, so friends knew about my helpless habit, and they bought me all 15 hours, whatever it is. So I have a stack of them, and I guess that's my most secret solitary pleasure. And if anyone else has anything like that, could we talk afterwards? Because it's kind of lonely. I mean, I know it's old culture and all that. So let's switch to the PowerPoint. It will happen, because I think the most intensive solitary pleasure that might not be part of my cultural discussion has to do with my origins as a painter and the concentration in privacy with perception, with looking, with the action of concentration, what the brush was going to bring from nature through the eye, through my musculature, and the fact that starting out as a landscape painter in many ways meant that I was only going to fail. Does the microphone go back okay? Way back there? You're so far away. It's horrible. Hi. Yeah. Invite them in? Yes, they can sit on the people in front and then they'll be cozy. You can come make a sandwich. You know, like that wonderful artist, what's his name, Tunick, who piles up all the bodies? It's such a good motive. So the failure as a landscape painter for me was that everything, and Cézanne had the same, you can come around, look, there's plenty of room. Cézanne had that same dilemma and wrote of his sorrow that his still life was always half dead when he came back the next day. For me, the dilemma was that the landscape was constantly changing. It was inspiring, invigorating, and the sensory intensity was always going to elude me. There was only so much that I could encompass. So in my early years when I'm in college, I'm drawing and drawing and drawing and wanting to really absorb form and feel that the life of forms is something that's in my momentum, in my perception, that I'm going to be able to transpose what I see. So it's not about the self, it's about what's perceived. Now I'm going way back because this is a very precocious image that I came upon not too long ago. It's done when I'm 4 years old. I know I'm four because that's my brother in a bassinet. And I think it's remarkable because it's not from imagination. It's a four-year-old kid studying, making a life drawing. How very odd that seemed. He's throwing a toy. The protuberances, now some of you know my work, and I want to remind you those are little feet. It's, the other part is coming soon, but not yet. It's a side view, and it's already about action and a dynamic. So I'm taking, many years later, a study that I'm doing in university of my partner, James Tenney, because we don't have life models, and he's willing to have a nap while he's naked between classes so that I can paint the figure. And I'm very engaged with this process, and I feel that I'm really getting to understand color field and defining form by color, the fractured line, and then the Bar Junior Committee wants to take the painting out of the exhibit. Now, it's not because there's three pussies in it. Do you all see the three cats? If you stop looking at the cock, you might see this. There's three cats. Does everybody see three cats, two cats? Should I point to them? Yeah, okay. There's one, there's this one, and that one. So those are continuing the inspiration of the cat as it interacts with the process. It's the same cat, Kitsch, who's going to influence fuses. Another early painting from life, it's Jane Brackage, at the time, the partner of the filmmaker Stan Brackage. Again, the art committee, the faculty said there was a very bad painting. Well, I forgot to mention why I was going to fail as a landscape painter. I was also going to fail as a painter because, as my professor said, the professor I liked, he said, don't set your heart on art, kid. You're only a girl. So this painting was considered bad because her expression was hostile, her legs were too fat, and what else? Maybe that was enough. And here are little documents of the solitary pleasure of concentrating, of working, that kind of perfect state of self-absorption and self-loss. Whoops, that's not supposed to be there. Well, let's work with it. Let's go one forward and then we'll go back. So this is University of Illinois in a tiny little studio where I had the sense of such potentiality with my materials, but really not knowing what could happen, what could it mean. So at the same time, 1957, the cat that you just saw with the nude male figure makes a painting. And I'm going to keep referring to the presence and the shared process of life and elements with these exceptional cats. I've also had very boring, ordinary cats, and they won't be discussed tonight. But Kitsch is the cat who inspires fuses by what I've written about her shameless observation, her shameless purring and presence while the couple is making love. And this was a painting, as it says, shoe polish on newspaper, and it does kind of resemble what maybe a sort of communist symbol of sort. Unfortunately, her career was ruined because when I had left the room to answer the phone and I had been polishing shoes, and when I came back, the cat had the little brush in her mouth and was completing a second stroke, and I screamed and said, "Oh my God, how can this be?" So she went on to play the harpsichord when there was one around sitting up. Whoops, I'm going wrong. Okay, it's still university, and the solitary pleasure is beginning to introduce elements from the cultural field, including my sweetheart's underpants dipped in plaster. They were considered obscene, and again, that the presumption that a young woman or a girl would interfere or kind of devalue a masculine symbol, that was objected to. The figure overseeing the painting construction is Sir Francis Henry Taylor, photographed by Julia Margaret Cameron. And that was important to me because Julia Margaret Cameron was not only a pioneering Victorian photographer, but the great aunt of Virginia Woolf. There's a map of Illinois. There are some nudes. So the work is beginning to pull in collage elements from the culture, as is this one. And the solitary pleasure now of moving out of university with Tenney to finding a loft in New York City, a huge, empty Ferrier's loft. I mean, it's not empty there. And just that intensive satisfaction of an open territory. Most of you know that in the early 60s, small industries left the lofts in New York City. Findings, bindings, zippers, buttons, all these little manufacturing places suffered economically. And then the artists found these big, rough places with DC current. They were $50 or $60 a month for half a city block in New York City. So that was really an open territory. At this time, I begin my film, self-shot 16-millimeter fuses that some of you know. Go back. I'll go back just because the cat, Kitsch, appears as the recurrent theme that's going to go through all the work. This is all self-shot footage with the wind-up Bolex, so that means there's always risk and uncertainty as to what that lens is actually going to capture. But somehow in my mind, it's as if the cat is somehow controlling everything. Collaged, thickly, densely collaged, so that when it finally went to the printer, they said they couldn't print it because it was too fat. I was always very nervous and worried if Frankie and Vinny would mind this erotic footage, because it was really forbidden. FBI was going through film labs in the 60s trying to find anything that they might consider obscene. With this image, I think it was this one, or one like this, these two tough big guys are shuffling their feet when they show me the image and they say, well, kid, does she like what he's doing? Actually, it's a cunnilingus image. Does she like it? And I say, well, yeah, otherwise she would have asked him to stop. And then they said, if I went home and did that with my wife, Jesus Christ. But what they told me later was that they had the biggest porno lab in the basement, these same two guys. Yeah. Here's a brief interlude self-shot image with Kitsch. We're alone in a kind of miserable interlude of isolation, separation. I'm doing a film with, you know, the bad lover, the betraying lover. There's tiger images that are superimposed. But I'm splitting the frame. It's an exorcism work where I'm able to take old 8 and print it onto a 16 frame, and so the dissolution of the relationship enters the formal properties of the filmmaking itself. Now here's a happier image, also from probably 4 years old. I call it the exuberant cat. And I'm fascinated by it in its simplicity and the energy of that gesture, and I keep discovering these reoccurrences of energy through the earliest drawings with events that happen in time frames where I wouldn't have known about the drawings anymore. So this is the beginning of a work that preoccupies me for 10 years. My neighbor, where I've lived on Springtown Road all these years, came to prune the apple tree, and then he went off for lunch. So I thought, I wonder what that feels like, and it was remarkable and such a free and complex sensation of floating while holding your musculature within the harness. Now this work, as some of you know, begins or continues the trouble out of fuses with how are you defining a separation, a declivity between pornography and eroticism. Because there's a very famous art historian at a conference who sees this. What was his name? Who knows? Goffin with a G? He's the major sociologist in the 70s. No guesses, huh? Well, maybe we'll think of it together later. So he sees this projected at a 20th century cultural conference, and he says, this is sadomasochism, that a woman with a harness and a rope cannot change that symbology that is fixed. It's embedded. And I'm very distressed and asked him, did he ever swing on a swing? And, you know, that's not within the cultural iconography of the sociologist swinging anywhere. And to try and finally to dissuade him, the artist Dick Higgins, who's attending, stands up and says, Mr. Goffman. Irving Goffman. Yes. He says, Mr. Golfman, no, first I'm saying to the organizer, could you get that little guy out of here? Could you just, you know, he's ruining everything. Could you just ask him to go? And somebody says, no, that's Irving Golfman. He's running the program here. And then Higgins stands up and he's imposing. And he says, Mr. Golfman, the rope is innocent. Yes. So this looks interesting, but I can't read it. It says the elusive rhythms. Wait, not yet. Okay, so up to including her limits becomes this installation, and that's how I resolve removing the self and sustaining the dynamic of the work itself. It's going to take 6 monitors. One of the drawings, which will have been done over a time frame of 8 to 10 hours, where I go on and off the rope, constantly extending my arm, letting the swing of the rope determine the energy and the reach. Is there any question about that? Sort of in between everything? No one would exhibit this piece. I felt it was a significant solution to several formal possibilities, and I couldn't get anyone to show it. Fortunately, now it is in my exhibit at the Dorsky Museum in New Paltz, and it is one of the rare works that's been purchased. Another version of it is at the Reina Sofia in Madrid, and that's a thrilling tale. So, into the 70s, the solitary pleasure has to do with recapturing aspects of intimacy. This is the double projection film Kitsch's Last Meal. The cat is 17 years old, and I make a deal with death because I think that's what film always demands. I will film the cat until she dies, and the death of the cat will be the exchange, because film so often divests, destroys, breaks up what you're looking at, what your central possessive need is from your imagery. So I film the cat, what she's watching and what she's eating, every other day for 3 or 4 years with my partner, Anthony McCall, who's having this wonderful renaissance with his projection work now. So that's what he looked like in 1975. The work with the cat continues with a cat named Clooney, who is the first of the kissing cats, the first of the Arden cats, who insists every morning before I get out of bed or before my partner and I do anything in bed that there's this ritual kissing. Here's an image of the cat traveling with me to an exhibit. He's climbing the ladder of the installer. And here's one of the predictive images from the 5-year-old preoccupations. The cat is dominant. I'm very interested. I do another lecture about the broken staircase, the broken frame. This is not a good drawing. Maybe I'm 6 or 7 because it's struggling with a kind of personification, but it's important to me that that linear break of the chain on the cat is defining the space. That's going to be a way that I organize all the paintings from here on in. The cat also is the main persona. The person it belongs to is secondary. The shoes are complicated, but the cat is the feature of the frame and is indicating this momentum and also indicating this agreeable situation to be on a leash. So we're going to see more of that, the cat confirming intimate relationships, and that the solitary pleasure for me is going to be examining the images further and further, printing them, permutating them, until here, after a series, it's not exactly the kiss, but it's the kitten, with that self-definition. So I'm doing these little shots with a 35-millimeter camera, Olympus, because I want to have a sense of what does this image look like. It feels so very odd and remarkable. And after the course of several years, I've built this grid where each image is inverted, and the grid is about 7 feet high by 5 feet across. The cat has begun to watch all the images as they're printed and laid out on the floor. He sits with his paw folded and he looks down. And he's a cat who can put thoughts in your mind very strongly, and you'll see some more of them. And this thought was, this is our best work. Not only is this our best work, but this is a portrait that the cat takes of me. This is actually by Vesper, the reincarnation of the first kissing cat. The camera is on my chest. I'm waiting to photograph the cat coming here, and then I'll shoot the kisses. But the cat comes up, looks at me, and presses the cable release. So I didn't expect there'd be anything on the film, and then this thing, which is all red mouth, I thought, out of perspective, just wonderful. Good work, kitty. Yeah. So the other part of the story is that the cat's leaning over, watching the images, and saying, this is our best work. When a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art San Francisco writes and says, send me some examples of this infinity kisses that you're working on. So I say to the cat, another hopeless endeavor, we'll wrap some up and send them. And the cat says, oh no, they're going to want this. And then I get the letter from the trustee saying, the acquisitions committee has voted to purchase this work. So at the same time, after Clooney dies, someone leaves a book in my house, someone I hardly know who's been staying over. It's a book of Egyptian hieroglyphs in which this fragment appears. And it's part of a hieroglyphic fragment that's described as the breath of life. And it describes a young woman exchanging breath with a lion so that she will have revelations for her culture. Whoops, what does that mean? Okay. All right, let's go to Vesper's Pool, the DVD. So this is the solitary pleasure of containing the cat's life and death. It's looping. Yeah. Back to PowerPoint. I'll just show one more sequence of this particular retrieval, this concentration that brings the pleasure of the work into realization out of all its uncertainty. I'll just show one more section of it, and then I want to present two recent DVDs, which are not explicitly about the animal and how the animal represents normalcy and the balance of fragile domestic life. So is this okay? Go ahead. Yeah. After the cat dies, Vesper, the second kissing cat, a strange accumulation of odd little events begin, which are of furtive, fugitive, fragile. In this particular, and I begin to document them, I'm not sure why or what they're going to become, but in this instance, the cat has a kind of leukemia that thins a blood vessel, and he's bleeding from his neck. He bleeds, he sneezes onto a text by one of my students who has just written an essay about her son having an injured ear and bleeding onto the page. The cat sneezes and his blood falls on the sentence about her son's bleeding. So this becomes a kind of diary of these strange little events, and I begin to track them. The cat has died, and I have my first job away for the Massachusetts College of Art in Portland, and as a visiting artist, they rent an apartment for me next to Vesper Street. That's very strange. It's a Congregationalist town, and the Vesper is from a Catholic ritual. There are two little streets called Vesper Street in Portland. So I go to talk to the town historian to see if he can give me some history. Why is the street named this way? The town historian lives out by the beach on the little Vesper Street. And he's gorgeous. He's not like what I thought the town historian would be. He's like got a cowboy hat, he's in tight white jeans, and he drives a 4x4 truck, and I'm just sort of dazzled, and I'm asking my questions, and as we're speaking, a gull comes in from the ocean directly over our heads. It circles around, and it drops a big feather at my feet. So I take the feather home. Then at home, a deer falls into my pond and drowns there. Friend has to come and rope it and drag it out, but it's not quite an ordinary dark-tailed deer. It has the markings of Vesper. This dove comes fluttering through the woods when I'm out by the pond thinking about life and death and the cat, and this dove suddenly comes in and hovers over me. There's all kinds of other acres where it could be. It's right in front of me. It trembles, and it falls down right in front of my feet on its back, and I put my hands under it, and I say, I'm sorry, I can't save you. You're going to die here, but I'll watch over you. And it dies. It immediately closes its eyes, and it's dead. So the version you see here is my own taxidermy. I'm sorry, it's vodka and cotton. So, yeah, the bird has lost some of its gorgeousness. But this becomes a major work, a major installation, and right now it's at the Dorsky Museum. It's a very large facade with all these units of the mystery story of the elements, and then as you come around the back of that wall, there's a video spill, because I wanted to toughen it up with, you know, get a technology that would toughen this kind of mystical uncertainty of communication with a dead animal. So as you come around the wall, there's this flow of images moving vertically based on what you saw of the cat's life and death. So to go beyond that, I'm going to show you a work in which the cat kiss, you're going to see the cat kiss appear. Devour is a museum-scale installation. We'll just have to see it in a small double frame. It's a work that was based on disaster footage that was being sent to me serendipitously from Sarajevo, from Lebanon, from Palestine, from Haiti. This very disturbing, violent imagery just kept turning up unexpectedly. Friends seemed to be sending it the way the mystical properties had sent elements from the dead cat, and I thought, I have to work with this, and it's going to have to be the duality between the violence and images of ordinary life and its devour. So we'll try that here. The sound is all found and dragged, and every image has been edited intensively. Sound up, up, up. Yeah. Okay. The first image is there's a lot of miracle images that I was able to capture. That huge bird was just a turkey vulture in my driveway, but it came out grand. And this first sequence was from a place where I couldn't go, a Puerto Rican barber shop. And I was in the street, and the shop must have been, you know, probably 14 feet away. And I thought, I'll never get it, but that's absolutely what I want for this film, that risk, that vulnerability, that, you know, opening up the delicate part of the body to the razor and knowing that you're safe and it's secure, that ritual. I'll just show one last work. Do you want to ask me anything about Devour before I mentioned, it should be huge. Each image should be about 10 feet by 12 feet projected so that you're walking within all that dynamic. And then the color is very intense. The pixels are huge and in motion. Well, I'll show you the last work. It's the one that I care about most because it's the most recent. It's a version of a large installation that's about 60 feet long by 20 feet wide. It's called Precarious. It's about motion in captivity. It's about the freedom of moving within a frame or a constriction. And it's projected through a mirror system. So when it's in its full position, again, the viewers are walking within it. Okay. Okay. So now I can move around on my leash. And I'm happy to take any kind of question. They don't have to be complicated. Hang on, I'm going to start the question twice. She's saying she notices a lot of repetition in the images that use certain motifs.
And mirror images. And I was wondering how you relate that to, in particular, the body and the mortal body, all types of bodies in your work.
And how do I relate that to a mortal body? Oh, boy, I wish I knew. What do you think?
Well, I think repetition, at least in my opinion, it's this funny sort of statement of the fact that things die and things are alive.
And I guess what I would say is that there's an iconographic inheritance that all of you will have that at some point. Some of it is innate, some of it will be culturally acquired, and some of those particular affinities or habits or gestures are things that you'll work against. So I'm very interested now in seeing the recurrence and that kind of patterning that can define or explicate aspects of the work from childhood right through. but I'm not sure. I can only talk about it in terms of something very, very specific, like a certain stick with a notch in it that goes through some painting constructions and then becomes a form of the interior scroll when it's folded, that then relates to a lightning rod. So... It's complex. How do viewers respond or understand the Vesper work? The cat work is has another layer of taboo, much as the erotic sexual work addresses taboos. In this case, the cat is fluffy, hyper female. It's an indulgence to build an intensive relationship with a pet, with a pussycat, when the whole world is in its own contradictions and dilemmas. So I'm really pushing against the suppression of that particularity, of that intimacy, that it is culturally devalued. Although if you go into cat lore as such, then there's this vast history that starts in really in Egypt of the strange, sacred, paranormal potentialities of an ordinary, or a not quite ordinary cat. So I guess that kind of answers your question, does it? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I like it, but, you know, it's hard to hear. Yeah, the ears are... Can we get a mic to the question people? Because they'll never hear back there.
Well, I guess now I'm right here.
Yeah, come on over. You'll be our first victim. Thank
yeah,
you.
I might kiss you, though, if I get this close. Mm.
Yeah. You no, could do, I, you do a cat kiss?
Sure. Well, okay. Well, then. So since that happened, that I don't. Can you hear?
Now
this?
We're engaged.
Does this make sense? Yeah.
No, you have to come home so, and lie on my chest.
Oh wow! Oh, thank you for the invite. Well, I did want to say specifically about that image, the first film that was shown, the cat kiss, and I managed to kiss you now. My question may change, but. On the website, you know, viewing the work, you know, such an artist as yourself to get to see video work of your caliber, you really have to be at the right museum in the right country at the right time to ever see that footage roll. You know, what yeah. mainly we would see as public or art students, et cetera, you would see stills. Right. And so seeing the still of the cat piece while it was... beautiful in the compositions and creates different mutations of the face where the two faces meet. It was really quite poetic to see the film in motion and see this passing of light mm-hmm. From one still to the next still. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's just
thanks,
very, you know, you feel the poetry of that and everything before you even said it, of the passing of life and then finding more about your cat lore, all of the history that feeds your work. Really comes through the piece, as should in film, if fortunate enough to. But my question was, I had two, and one was mainly to ask you if you were interested at all to articulate about the experience. You had mentioned, you said it was a favorite teacher, and then you followed up that comment. It was the beginning of the lecture saying that the teacher in school had told you about your paintings, talking to you about your paintings, not a future of painting, kid, girl, something
right.
to that
yeah.
extent.
Uh-huh.
And then knowing that that was early in your career and you continued on your path and then were also the first female art professor at Rutgers, I think, in the 70s. So you really broke serious ground in many ways. And I was just wondering if you wanted to articulate at all on that experience.
Well, I'll try a little bit. I mean, thank you. That was kind of a nightmare because the resistance in university was hard for us to imagine now. When I, as I always say, I wanted to write a paper for my philosophy course at Bard, where I had room, board, tuition, because my dad wouldn't send me to college, and Bard took me. It was amazing, one of the miracles. And I had this charming Southern professor, Bill Lensing, for philosophy. And so I went to him and said, I'd like to do my paper on Simone de Beauvoir. And he grimaced and he said, well, honey, why you want to write a paper on a mistress when you can write a paper on the master? So I could write on Sartre, but not Beauvoir. So that was the way it was, this absolute, this wall of cultural tradition that really didn't shift and break until the feminist rebellion and excitations and redefinitions of culture in the 70s. So the early works I was doing in the 60s were also considered obscene or inappropriate. Gallery people came into a person, there were men and women, they said this work was bad, shit, not my cup of tea. So I didn't have anyone from a gallery come by for about 10, 12 years. It was too discouraging. I just kept plodding along, and partly due to the inspiration or the stability of my partner, the musician and composer, and the influence of his music and his struggle. And as you all know, in the early 60s, there wasn't a big commerce for art. Only a few grandiose abstract expressionist males had made it and entered the pantheon. So the sense of being marginal and struggling was very common among all of us, except that the conversations were all focused on and directed by our guys. You know, the women, we all sat around in little skirts smoking cigarettes and drinking whiskey, and the guys discussed everything. So does that go towards your question?
Yeah.
Next time, it has to be slow. The cat's very slow. Next question.
One last, two questions.
We could do two little ones, okay. Yeah.
Dancers.
Can you come and tell? Say it in the mic, because it's interesting. Okay. It's a little complex. Yes.
No, so should I rephrase that?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good.
Well, I'm just curious about the way that these films we've seen today relate to some of your historical films, and Fuses in particular. I was talking about this great film everyone should see, Cheryl Donegan made, which reimagines Fuses as refuses, using internet images to create a kind of frame-by-frame reproduction of Fuses with contemporary technology and information systems. So I'm just curious about the way that you're using a lot of, like, you know, found footage now. The editing seems kind of similar to Fuses with the fade-ins and the cuts. But the material seems to have changed. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what your relationship is to the kind of information technology that you're using and the way you see that impacting your filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, that's yours. I don't need that one. Okay, I got this one. I'm really involved and entranced with the video process and being able to develop ways of editing video so that it's very painterly. And I can't escape my own aspect of rhythmic structure. For instance, Precarious is almost edited in a waltz time. It's 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-1-2, 1-2-1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. So there's always some implicit musicality. With Kitsch's Last Meal is actually a score. I guess the only answer is that the access to video and an editor that's so harmonious and sympathetic to what I want to do, because some of what I want to do isn't quite possible in the programs as they exist, but we find a way. And I don't know if that engagement answers your question, but the scale is something that is missing when we see it in this proportion. And the scale is what I really care about now, is having these really intensive environments in which you walk and move within the imagery. Yeah, and one more is this one. And you're close. You can do that.
I'm just wondering, as viewers, we're noticing that a lot of images and narratives that you have for your videos and are very personal. And so when we're viewing it, a lot of things might get lost in translation and we might not know the work to its full extent as you do, as a creator. So I'm wondering if there's any message or a feeling that you hoped that the viewers would take away after viewing your work.
Okay. Could you all hear that? Because it's interesting. Yeah. I think my position is the creator has to disappear. The force field is the work and what can be realized through the history and commitment of this art process. It's not about me so much as it's about how I translate lived experience and can incorporate that as a form of actuality, and that this has always been in contradistinction to the heroic ideality of the director, the overseer, usually the male figuration who is training and teaching and having other people do what comprises his energy and vision. So I tend to use myself as a testing ground, and then I wanted to move out. And if viewers see works and don't know anything about my own history, that's fine. You know, the work has to go on its own. So thank you, everybody. This was really amazing.